Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week, my special guest is Trey Suntrop, PhD. He is a product engineer who earned his doctorate degree in physics and electrical engineering from the University of California, Santa Barbara in 2015. He is currently the head of product at Readout Health, the St. Louis startup that recently launched the BioSense Breath Ketone Meter. Following a successful clinical trial in the autumn of 2019, BioSense has entered the consumer, clinical, and research market as a tool to help those wanting to lose weight or manage blood glucose with a ketogenic diet. In this interview, Trey discusses breath acetone testing and how it can be used to improve health outcomes. He shares some of the results of the clinical trial supporting the BioSense meter, including finding that measurements must be collected multiple times daily to truly evaluate the benefit of a ketogenic or intermittent fasting plan. He also describes some of the advantages of breath testing over blood ketone measurement. Just before we get into this week's episode, I want to thank everyone who so generously supports this podcast on Patreon. Without your support, we wouldn't be able to keep this podcast independent and free of ads. So thank you. And just a reminder, as a Patreon supporter, not only do you have my eternal gratitude, but also you get some awesome gifts, including 20 to 35% discounts on all supplements we recommend when working with clients, which saves many of our supporters $50 to $100 a month over what they were previously spending on Amazon. So by supporting the podcast, they're actually spending less money each month. In addition to that, you also get access to our office hours, where my scientific director, Megan, answers questions twice a week. You can submit all your own questions, as well as listen to the replays covering everything from black mold to the best ways to brush your teeth. We've worked really hard to make sure that the bonuses you get are actually way more valuable for you, whatever level you choose to support us at. So if you'd like to support the podcast and get access to the discounts and office hours, just head over to mbt.link and you can sign up there. Again, that's mbt.link. Thank you so much. And now let's head over to this week's interview with Trey Suntrop. Well, Trey, thank you so much for joining me this morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here talking to you.
Excellent. Excellent. I'm so excited to talk to you today about breath acetone and how we might measure it. I was first introduced to your work by Jim McCarter, who has been on this podcast twice before, talking about the fantastic work that Virta Health are doing. And also my colleague Douglas Hilbert has been very helpful in telling me all about Virta and the fantastic work that they were doing. Jim came down and spent the day with me in Santa Cruz last year, and he was saying, oh, you must talk to these guys that are making this fantastic breath acetone meter. And I must admit, I sort of rolled my eyes a little bit because I tinkered around with these breath acetone meters before, and I wasn't terribly impressed. But I have a feeling that might be part of the reason why your company decided to get into this space. Maybe just park that question for a moment. And why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and how you became interested in the biotech space?
Sure. My background's in science and physical science and engineering. So physics and electrical engineering are my PhD, is what my PhD is in. So I did those degrees in Southern California, actually out not too far away from where you are. I spent some time in industry as well up in the Bay Area as a product developer. And then, you know, after a while in the physical science space, it's nothing against what those folks are doing because they're doing fantastic work in a lot of cases, but I just didn't feel connected enough to the benefit of the technology. I didn't feel like, you know, I was really helping people with what I was doing. So that's really when my interest turned to the healthcare space. You know, it's such a massive opportunity to improve people's health and improve health span, lifespan. And I really wanted to get into that. So the way I did that was to actually move back to my hometown in St. Louis, Missouri, and take a postdoctoral fellowship at Washington University Med School. And really what we did there is the focus was on medical entrepreneurship. So academic faculty members who are interested in commercializing their technologies, but may not know how to take those first steps to get there, but then also a focus on clinical research. So that's how I was really able to kind of make that pivot from physical science to health sciences. And I had been working with a couple of venture capital firms here in St. Louis when this company, Readout Health, came across my radar. And a combination of the technology, the founding team, which included Jim McCarter and, you know, our founder, Tim and Matt Ratto, the team was just so impressive. The technology was so impressive. And the problem that they were trying to solve was so pressing that it was really an easy call for me to get involved.
That's fantastic. What are the challenges for an academic that wishes to become an entrepreneur?
Wow, that's a great question. I think probably one of the biggest ones is the cultural differences between academia and industry. And, you know, honestly, the way that I was exposed to that was through an industrial job with a bigger company. So just kind of the cadence is very different in industry, right? So for the first time in my life, when I took an industry job, I had my boss come up to my desk and say, "Hey, Trey, I need this, you know, analysis done or whatever." And I'd say, "Great, when do you need that by?" And he would say, "I need it in like 45 minutes.
Anytime in the next 45
yeah,
minutes.
Yeah, anytime. Right, if it's 20, I'll be fine with it, right? So, you know, that is very different for academia, right? Where, you know, just and it's nothing inherently wrong with the way the academic process works. It's just research is typically a much slower thing. So really the cultural shock, I think, is the biggest part. But really it's about exposure. It's about developing the network and the contacts of folks who are willing to help you and are willing to answer all your questions. And I was extremely annoying in my early days and would just ask a million questions of everybody that I got around. So that's probably not a great answer, but you know, it's...
No, it is. It is. It is a great answer. I think we can skip over why ketones, right? So at this point, I think that most people listening will be sympathetic to the idea of ketogenic diets and the pleiotropic effect of ketones. And, you know, I've done many great interviews, including two with Jim McCarter, but then also Dominic D'Agostino. Ken Ford has been very good on this topic. Brianna Stubbs, I've done multiple podcasts with her. Catherine Crofts, and of course, our scientific director, Megan Hall. Her paper, "A Ketogenic Diet Extends Longevity and Health Span in Adult Mice," was published in the journal Cell Metabolism a couple of years back. And so I think at this point, my listeners are like, kind of, okay, you're like, you don't need to convince me on why ketones might be beneficial. You know, the question is, or you know, how do you measure it? And what is the importance of breath acetone? So tell me about the different ways you could possibly measure ketosis. And can you talk about some of their advantages or disadvantages?
Absolutely. I think that's a really good place to start. So really, there are three main ketone bodies: acetoacetate, beta-hydroxybutyrate, and acetone. Those are really the three main ketone bodies. Each of those has a test that is sensitive to that particular ketone body. So I think most people are familiar with blood tests. The blood, you know, finger prick test strip system is really sensitive to beta-hydroxybutyrate. The urinary test strips are sensitive to the excess acetoacetate that your body is essentially getting rid of in the urine. Right. So there's a chemical reaction that takes place on that test strip. And, you know, we can tell you the concentration approximately, or a range of concentrations where your excreted acetoacetate is likely to lie. And then there's this third ketone body, which is acetone, which, because of its small size, it's volatile. It actually diffuses into the airways of your lungs and is expelled in the breath. So that's another non-invasive way to measure ketones. Now, the really interesting question, and I'm sure the one that we'll get into today, is how are these three related to each other? Because they are not interchangeable. So measuring beta-hydroxybutyrate and measuring, you know, acetoacetate in your urine, those aren't really telling you the same thing. And I think with those two examples, people have kind of caught on to that, particularly folks who are more highly involved in the keto space. I think they understand what some of the drawbacks of a urinary test are. One that's most commonly discussed is the fact that as the body adapts, you stop dumping ketones into your urine at the same rate. So if you just start a ketogenic or low carb diet, you know, your urinary ketones go up for the first couple weeks and then they drop, even though you're still in ketosis. So it could be a reasonable way. Again, it's fairly imprecise because they just give these ranges of ketone values. But, you know, to give you a general idea, when you're just starting out, urinary ketones may be able to get the job done. It's really not used a ton in the, you know, type 2 diabetes space because of the non-quantitative nature of the test.
And you raise an important point here is, you know, why would you bother testing at all? I think Ken Ford has actually been particularly good on this, is that a ketogenic diet is the only diet where you can objectively know that you're doing it, right? Like, you think of all the different diets.
Well, that's a great point. I love that point, actually, right? Because for everything else, it's just weight, right? And, you know, we know how unreliable that is. We know how that can be influenced by your sodium intake, because that determines how much water you're retaining, muscle mass if you're going to the gym, right? All those things. And the fact that, you know, there's really not a perfect sort of lockstep correlation between, if your goal is weight loss, for example, you know, the fat that your body is losing in your weight, right? Because of those other factors.
So yeah, I mean, that's going to be very disheartening if you think you're doing it right because you're starting to see ketones in your urine and then those ketones start to disappear, then that's a problem, right? So at MBT, we're huge fans of validated learning. And I think our neurologist, Josh Turknet, has been super good on this as well. This idea of play, assess, refine, right? So first of all, you need to play the game. And in this case, it's eating a ketogenic diet. And then you need to assess somehow. And that might be by measuring ketones in breath or urine or blood. And then you refine, right? Like, oh, I didn't get any. So I need to change something about my diet, right? And so you keep going around in iterations and so you get better and better. But if the test changes as you make changes, then that's kind of a problem that needs to be solved. So it seems like...
Absolutely. So, I mean, the feedback from a psychological perspective is just so important. And there's lots of great social science research on feedback and the way that it actually motivates people to continue. Any lifestyle dietary change program, feedback is so, so important. So first of all, you have to have some, right? That's essentially what you're saying, which is that, you know, you have to be told how you're doing. You have to, right? If you're just in the dark, sort of, you know, punching into the air, you're really not going to stick with it. And we all know this, right? From our own lives and experimenting ourselves. So that feedback's really important. And then the tighter the feedback loop, so I make an action and then I get the output of that action, the tighter you can make that, the more folks are going to stick with whatever program they are, the faster they're going to learn, you know, the more they're going to enjoy the process. So it's not just the existence of the feedback, it's also, you know, the distance between the action that I took and the feedback that I get on that action is super, super important.
Right. So I imagine, you know, you're hitting a ball over a net in a game of tennis, and then I write a letter and mail it to you and tell you whether it was in or out.
Right. Yeah, great analogy.
That's not as good. And also, ketosis is a relative term, right? You could argue, oh, well, if you're eating less than 50 grams of carbohydrate a day, then surely you're in ketosis. But ketosis is definitely a relative term. And Ryan Baxter from our forum was super good recently when he pointed me at a study of endurance runners that were eating up to 400 grams of carbohydrates a day, but that was not sufficient to avoid ketosis, right? So if you're an athlete, which I think many of my listeners are, then you can probably eat a lot of carbs and still be in ketosis. So like anything you've read on the internet about, you know, if you're eating below this, then you're in ketosis by definition, I don't think that's true.
Right. And that's even another reason for monitoring, right? So everybody's body is different, of course. And it not only depends on your genetics, on all the different peculiarities of your metabolism, your insulin sensitivity, all that stuff, but also on your activity level, which not only is going to be vary with individual, so person to person, but also within an individual. Maybe I have an active week this week compared to another week. You know, during quarantine, I spent a lot of time sitting in a chair, unfortunately. I was not so great at keeping active during that period. So, you know, even within my own case, my own individual case, it varies week to week. So you're exactly right. And we'll probably get into the clinical trial that we ran last fall a little bit later, but we had an endurance athlete in that trial who was playing those exact same games. So he was training for an Ironman, was really trying to stay in ketosis and figure out, you know, on days when I take a 100-mile bike ride, can I eat a bowl of rice for dinner and still stay in it? You know, exactly what you're saying. So, you know, a device like ours really enables those types of experiments.
So what's the problem with measuring blood beta-hydroxybutyrate? Is it just the cost?
Well, there are two primary, I guess, issues with it. The first is the cost, because there's a disposable cost with it, right? So the blood strips are at least $1 a piece. They can be more. So if you're trying to measure, you know, we were just talking about feedback, right? And tight feedback loop and frequency. If you're trying to measure, you know, multiple times per day, which is going to be necessary to really give you that feedback on what you're doing, and we can talk about the reasons for that later, then, you know, the dollar a strip is, you know, over the course of a year, for example, you know, $350 if you're just doing once a day. And essentially what we show, you know, one of the main outputs of our trial is that your ketones actually vary so much during the course of a day that if you just take one measurement, in many cases, you miss a lot of the picture of your daily ketone variability. So if you start to think about 2-3 times a day, maybe even more, you know, we have users who get a little bit addicted to measuring and we'll do 8 measurements per day, right? In those cases, the economics are just not tenable in a blood device.
So are you not impressed with any of the other meters on the market that perhaps offered cheaper test strips?
Oh, the blood devices, you mean?
Of the blood devices, I'm pretty sure. You know, I don't want to name names, but I know there are definitely devices on the market now that offer cheaper test strips.
Yeah, typically when the test strips are cheaper, there's a reason for it, right? And typically it involves processing or storing costs that are such that the quality of the measurement goes down. That's a general statement that, you know, we've done some quality control measurements with a couple of the blood meters out there. And you do see with some of them with the cheaper strips, you know, you get numbers that can sometimes be all over the place.
Right. So the variation is higher.
Right. And, you know, we should make that general statement about blood meters. Obviously, you know, lots of people use them, but really the gold standard blood ketone measurement is a laboratory test, right? Any point of care test is going to be less accurate than a laboratory test. The question is just how much less accurate. So, you know, like I said, when we did our quality control measurements for our clinical trial with some of the blood devices, you know, we were using calibration fluid with these test strips, right, that are supposed to give you the same value each time or close to the same value. And we didn't see that. So even when you have the same fluid calibrated to the same ketone level, you still get some variation with the strips. Now, the reason for that is, you know, one of the main reasons that we can talk about is that when ketone strips are stored in, you know, a container together and they're repeatedly, you know, you might dump out 10 strips into your hand and then pull one out and put the rest back in the tube, for example, or, you know, you may take the top off 100 times and expose it to different things in the environment. And those factors can, you know, over time start to skew the measurements that you're getting. So the best blood test strips that we've seen are the ones that are individually packaged. But of course, individually packaged blood ketone strips cost more.
That makes sense. That makes sense. But so the nice thing about the blood meters, though, is I can make sense of the number. You know, I think this is an important thing in general with measuring anything. So I'll give you a different example. You know, when I first start working with an endurance coach like Simon and Les at Braveheart, the first thing they're going to do is have me do a functional threshold power test, you know, where I just ride my bike as hard as I can for 20 minutes with a power meter on the crank. And then I get back a number and I divide that number by my weight. And then I know basically how good my engine is, right? And I can compare that to other cyclists and know exactly how I compare, right? Like to anyone. And so that I make sense of that number in that way. And you could argue that the same thing is true with blood beta hydroxybutyrate. Like, you know, I can pretty much every paper in the scientific literature is using the same blood BHB thing. So there's a way for me to directly compare the number I see on my handheld meter with what I've seen in the literature or what someone talked about on a podcast, right? It is comparative, but you know, so what do you do with breath acetone? Like, how would you compare that to anything?
Yeah, good question. So a lot of the other breath acetone meters, they'll either give some sort of range or arbitrary number, like say like a 3, which, you know, is on a scale from 0 to 6, say, or, you know, will give you sometimes a result in parts per million, you know, parts per million concentration breath acetone. So what we did to address exactly the issue that you just raised is we try to map our breath acetone readings onto an equivalent blood unit. So the way we do that is with this unit called ACEs. And this is a unit which looks at the historical data and our own data comparing blood BHB to breath acetone and essentially maps the parts per million breath acetone reading onto that BHB reading. And the correspondence between our unit and BHB is a 10-to-1, approximately 10-to-1 correspondence. So if you were to get a 10 on our device, that's like getting a 1 on the blood meter. So to your point, you know, we knew people were familiar with those units. We knew we were going to have to, you know, we didn't make them the exact same. We're not going to report out a 1 millimolar value from our meter because we're not measuring BHB, right? So in a way, we kind of had to thread this needle between, you know, we have to provide a number that people are familiar with and they can make sense of with this relationship to blood without actually reporting the blood unit itself.
Okay. And so tell us how you do that. So you've got blood, beta hydroxybutyrate, you've got acetoacetate, and then you've got breath acetone. And it's not necessarily a linear relationship, right? And so you developed this statistical model to map one to the other. Can you talk about how you did that?
There's actually not a ton of historical data on this topic. So if you dig into the literature and you look at papers that are comparing breath acetone to blood BHB, there are maybe between half a dozen and a dozen papers on this throughout history, right? So it's something that has been studied, but not extensively enough to produce a ton of data on the comparison and the correlation. So we took what data there was, and then we ran this clinical trial last fall where we had folks walk around with a blood meter. In this case, we used the Abbott Precision Extra for the blood meter and our device, and take simultaneous measurements with the two devices five times a day. So doing that, we actually generated over twice the amount of existing data comparing breath acetone and blood BHB. So the first thing you do to answer your question is to gather a bunch of data, right? You actually have to have a bunch of concurrent blood BHB and breath acetone measurements.
Right. So it's like a supervised machine learning task, right? Where you've got a dependent variable and then an independent variable, and your job is to map one onto the other.
That's exactly it. So then you just take all that data and you run regression analysis on it.
And just a simple linear regression was enough to do it then? You didn't need any fancy deep learning or some sort of random forest or boosted gradient boosting or anything like that?
We haven't tried that yet, but I mean, the actual relationship itself is nonlinear, but it's linear in the coefficients, right? So, I mean, technically the regression is linear, but if you actually look at the data, it does have a curve to it.
Right. Okay. And then, so tell me about the ground truth. You just told me that some of these blood meters might not be the absolute ground truth, right? You said that I'd have to bring you into the lab in order to get the ground truth, yet in your clinical trial, you use the Precision Extra meter. So isn't that going to affect your model?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we wanted to do, you know, we knew we were taking a breath acetone device into a market that didn't really trust breath acetone. So I think we really had our eyes open about that fact. We were not in denial about that fact. And actually, it's funny that you opened the podcast that way, because that's exactly the impression that we had, you know, before we launched this product. So what we had to do, or what we knew we had to do, is we had to come out with some proof, some clinical IRB-approved research that says that this device is measuring something useful, and it is doing it in a way that can be just as accurate as the current point of care blood meters. So if our aim was to say, let's study, you know, the physiology of breath acetone and blood BHB and do it in the, you know, the most accurate possible way, then yes, you would do laboratory measurements probably for both of these, right? Because the, you know, you can measure breath acetone using mass spectrometry. And in fact, that was done long before there was ever a portable device. So most of the research is done with these big laboratory tools to measure breath acetone based on mass spec. So if that was your aim, then that's probably what you would do. And then if you wanted to compare, you know, the point of care meters to each of those, you could do it. But for us, we were saying, look, here's what people are using if they're using anything. How do we stack up to that measurement technique?
Okay. Do you see a danger here of ethical fading? You know, like, so you get FDA approved for your thing and you're piggybacked off this other thing. And then somebody else, you know, another party comes along and they piggyback off of you. And suddenly this is kind of like the accuracy is gradually going down and down and down, as if you were making photocopies of photocopies of photocopies, if you see what I mean.
I don't think that that's how the FDA approval process would go. Anytime you have a diagnostic, you know, the FDA is pretty picky about the gold standards that you're using. So I think in our case, we would have to do more work than that. I don't think any of us thinks that the trial that we did last fall would secure us FDA approval, for example, to monitor a diabetes treatment or something like that. So, and in fact, that's why we haven't submitted that application yet. So I think we know that that trial would look differently than the one we've already conducted. So the short answer to your question is, I don't think that would fly with the FDA.
Okay. Okay, well, that's good to know. I appreciate your honesty. Thank you. So tell me about the people who are in the clinical trial. As someone has done some supervised machine learning tasks, I worry about the propensity matching problem. And it was actually Gary Clifford I interviewed way back in the day brought this up. The people who you trained your model on don't look like the people for whom you're making inferences, right? So say you have a small number of very similar people in your training data. So the endurance athlete case is a really good example. It turns out that you did have an endurance athlete in the training data, but imagine there wasn't, and then you get an endurance athlete in real life production. You know, is the model going to make good inferences for someone that they didn't see in training?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I'll start answering it by saying that I don't know. But we can talk about this a little bit. So the first thing to mention is that you know, our trial participants, there were 20 of them. They were generally healthy non-diabetics. We did have one diabetic subject in the trial, but that person was not insulin dependent. So, you know, if your point is, you know, you're taking a group of healthy people and, you know, making inferences about their ketones and now you want to go treat diabetics, like, I take your point. I think the thing you have to think about is there something about the ketone physiology, particularly in the comparison between breath acetone and blood beta hydroxybutyrate, that would be different in a diabetic case, for example, or an endurance athlete versus, you know, a healthy person or somebody who's metabolically healthy. I think you have to be very specific about it, because really the aims of the trial were to compare those two biomarkers. And so if the result is going to be non-representative of the general population, it will be because that comparison of those two biomarkers is somehow different in different populations. And whether or not that's the case, we simply don't know right now. I don't think we have reason to believe that it's substantially different in a type 2 diabetes population, for example, versus normal. But, you know, we don't know.
Okay. Okay. And so what was the variance like in the data you collected? I mean, it's encouraging that you were able to make it work with such a simple model. And I think that simple is probably better when it comes to supervised machine learning, right? If you'd have told me that, you know, there was only 20 people in the training data and you used a 100 layer tiramisu, fully convolutional deep neural network, then I might be worried you're a little bit
overfitting. You know, yeah.
But yeah, it sounds like the simple model that's really encouraging. But what was the variance like in the training data? Did you see like breath acetone all over the place, or was it pretty consistent among the participants?
Yeah, so there were actually some really interesting dynamics that we observed. So the correlation that we saw was between the two ketones, just straight correlation, was around 0.6. So just to put that number into context, the small amount of research that does exist comparing blood BHB and breath acetone found similar correlations. Now, what those studies didn't do is actually dig into that and try to explain that, right? And I think that that's really what we tried to do in our research, is to say, you know, let's actually peel back the onion a couple layers here and try to understand what's going on. Why is that not 0.95? Why is breath acetone not perfectly track blood BHB? And what we found there, and so that's essentially what you're asking, is you have some scatter around the fit line, right? And what we found is that when we started actually pulling people's data and looking at their individual traces over the course of a day, you start to see these really interesting effects. Like, for example, breath acetone changes typically occur after changes in blood BHB. So if you look at, you know, your blood ketones go up and then drop, your breath ketones tend to go up and then drop too, but maybe an hour or two later. So because of that, if you imagine doing a correlation on these traces that are actually shifted with respect to one another in time, then you could get correlations that would be lower than you would expect if those were actually co-varying right alongside each other.
Okay, that's very interesting. And so were you trying to do anything else in the clinical trial? Because one of the things that I'm sure everybody will be thinking is like, well, does breath acetone correlate with anything I really care about, right? I mean, so you could make some arguments. I think Ken Ford's been good on this again, that there are signaling properties of ketones and that you should care about those. You know, it's more than just a metabolic fuel. But, you know, I've also heard, you know, the keto gains guys have been quite good on this, that, you know, don't chase ketones, chase results. Like, you know, what is it you care about? Is it weight loss? Is it gaining muscle? Is it something else? I mean, sure, maybe you've got some neurological condition where it makes sense to maintain a certain level of ketones. But most people, they care about something else, right? They care about weight loss or muscle gain or something like that. And I was just wondering, was there another intervention in the clinical trial? And did that correlate with the breath acetone?
So it's a great question. And I think, you know, the most important thing for us, you know, medium term and long term, is the outcomes that you're talking about, right? Is actually being able to correlate the ketone levels that you see with some sort of beneficial clinical outcome. I think that that is absolutely, you know, top of mind for us. That's data that we don't have yet for our device specifically. But we are involved with several clinical trials with some leading academic institutions where we're starting to look at those types of questions. So as far as outcomes, you know, we're in the process of generating that data. As you know, with any sort of clinical research, that's going to take a little bit of time. But to answer the question about, does this correlate with anything that I care about? There's another very interesting result that came out of the trial. which is that, you know, a lot of people want to compare point by point of these two ketones, you know, breath acetone, blood BHB. And when you do that, you see these types of effects that we were just talking about with these time shifts. But when you actually zoom out and look at the whole day, what you see is that they're actually telling you almost the exact same thing. So when you zoom out and look at the whole day and you look at the ketone dose, so what is the amount of ketones that your body has been exposed to over the course of that day? The correlation between, you know, blood and breath is very high in that case. So the idea is really borrowed from drug discovery and the idea that you can do these time-weighted dose curves and basically say, you know, I'm going to inject some drug into you and then I'm going to monitor the concentration of that drug in your bloodstream over time. And the area under that curve is related to the dose that I gave you. So we said, hey, let's think about this a little bit. So ketones are just a molecule in your blood, and it's a naturally occurring molecule. So in that sense, it's not like a drug, but it is just a molecule circulating in your blood. And we can do the same thing, where if we look at the area under that curve, which requires you to take, you know, on the order of 3-4 measurements per day, we can understand the exposure of your body to ketones. And what we're really interested in looking at, again, medium and long term, is the correlation between that exposure and these outcomes that you're talking about. Because we suspect that it's really not, you know, your ketones were 1 millimolar in the morning and that's going to correlate perfectly with some beneficial health outcome. We think it's more likely going to be this cumulative exposure to ketones over time, and particularly the cumulative exposure for each day, that's really going to drive those outcomes.
Well, that was going to be my next question is, like, could you use this device to fine tune some sort of intermittent fasting? You know, like, regular listeners to the podcast will know that we're huge fans of early time restricted eating, that is eating breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince and dinner like a pauper, and then constricting your feeding window to something short, right? Like a lot less than the 12 hours that most Americans eat. And then, of course, you can then get into more complicated stuff like, you know, alternate day and like multi-day water fast and all this complicated stuff. But the, you know, the real question is, it's like, is this doing anything like helpful? Like, it's really, really hard for me to know that all of this, I mean, it's the most hard work that we talk about, I would say, like, or it's up there. And then, you know, people come up with these apps that allow you to track how long you've been fasting and stuff. I don't, it's basically a glorified egg timer, right? Like, I really don't care about that. What I really care about is this doing something to my biology? And that was my question for you is, could breath acetone help us understand that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question. So, you know, I think that if you buy into the beneficial effects of ketones in general, which, you know, we were talking about at the beginning that we kind of skipped that part because your audience essentially gets that. So there are things related to, you know, the reduction in oxidative stress that occur when your ketones get above a certain level, right? There are these down regulations of these inflammatory pathways. So that's just one example of why ketones would be beneficial as signaling molecules beyond just the new metabolic substrate, right? So if you were to say, you know, I really think that the benefit of fasting is tied to that, is tied to my body switching into this other state, then really, you know, what you want to be measuring are your ketones, not the time, right? And there are actually some interesting anecdotes surrounding that. So our founder has done a lot of experimentation with this device before the company was incorporated. So the device has been in development for, you know, 2 or 3 years now. And before there was even a company, he would hand these out to his friends and have them track their ketones. And there's an interesting story with one such person that he handed a device out to was fasting for religious reasons during, you know, sun up to sundown. And then at night was essentially binging on rice. And what this person found is that even though they had an entire day fast, they were never in ketosis, ever. They never burned through the glycogen that was stored up from eating all the rice at night, right? So this idea that you can just start a timer and then know where you're going to be 8 hours later really is not borne out by the data. It depends highly on what you've done before that. Before you start the timer, it depends on your activity level. It depends on a lot of different things. So yeah, you're absolutely right. The idea of replacing a timed fast with, you know, this ketone threshold fast, for example. So I'm going to fast until I hit a 10 on this device, right? And for you, that might take you 8 hours. It might take me 12 or 16 hours.
Okay. And you're quite sure that that will be the case, that breath acetone will correlate with something I might care about, like autophagy or fat burning.
Yes, yes. So we've seen this actually. So there are some there's a blog post on our website that tracks fasting with our device, and I can't remember if they did a blood measurement also, but folks have definitely done this, and you see them both rise. Again, it may not be in perfect lockstep. There might be, you know, an hour or two difference between, you know, when they hit their particular thresholds. But yes, absolutely. They definitely do track in a fast.
And then talk about some of the integration. So recently I was reading a really fantastic blog post. Marty Kendall did a really good blog post on the acetone to glucose ratio and the holy grail of tracking optimal glucose levels. And that was brought to my attention by Philippa on the forum. Really good. Like he started off good and he's only gotten better over time. And he raises this important point, which is maybe you need to know your glucose as well as the breath acetone, because that's going to tell you something about the total amount of energy in the system. So I'll resist the temptation to tell you the entire contents of that article. I would suggest you go read it. But what it suggests to me that it would be really nice to know my blood glucose levels at the same time as breath acetone. And I'm sure you're familiar with the continuous glucose monitors that are coming onto the market direct to consumer. There's now a number of companies that are offering these direct to consumer. So I just wonder, you know, is there going to be a point where I'll be able to integrate all these things?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. So combining glucose and breath acetone, there's just not much research on that yet. That's something that we would be really interested in supporting from a research perspective, because this GKI that people use is really between glucose and blood BHB. So I think what we don't want to do is pretend that, you know, we can just adopt that without doing some research of our own or doing research with an academic collaborator, right? I don't think that would be very responsible on our part. The short answer is we don't know what that metric looks like yet, because the research hasn't been done.
Right. And I agree, it's entirely speculative, right? But still, there's a technical problem to be solved, which is like, what am I supposed to do? Am I like supposed to track all these things in a spreadsheet? I mean, I suppose I could, but it seems like a solvable technology problem.
Sure. And these days, you know, with any type of biomarker tracker, integration is really important to users, and, you know, myself included in that, right? So I fully recognize the need for integrating with other apps. So that's something that we're doing on an ongoing basis. So we have integrations out with several apps. You know, one of the big ones is Chronometer in this space. You know, our device is fully integrated with the Chronometer app, and our data is just synced into that app if you want to track other biomarkers. I know glucose is one of them for them. They've got a bunch of others. And those integrations are going to continue, you know, as we mature as a company. We've got a couple really exciting ones in the pipeline that we're not actually allowed to talk about yet, but always willing and working toward more integrations with more of these data aggregator apps. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. And I saw you were integrated with Heads Up Health. I interviewed the founder, Dave Korsunsky. And so, yeah, I mean, if you can integrate with Heads Up Health, you've pretty much integrated with everything. Am I right?
That's right. And actually, our partnership with Heads Up is really interesting, because, you know, Heads Up, of course, has a consumer product, but they're also really interested in the clinic as well. So, you know, actually providing platforms to monitor these different biomarkers for patients, right? And that's something that we're really excited to kick off with them and actually do some case studies in the clinical market as well. You know, because we've talked a lot so far about regular folks like me or you who are interested in, you know, ketogenic diet, tracking ketones, but there's this whole other angle, which is, you know, clinicians who are essentially putting patients on these diets and then want to monitor them in a variety of ways. So we're starting to see that type of uptake, particularly with functional medicine docs who are really leading the charge on this, who are saying, look, I'm going to send you home with a BioSense and, you know, a couple other trackers, and we're going to use Heads Up to integrate all the data, and we're actually going to titrate your care based on what we see. And this is really leading edge stuff that we're really excited about. And I think the clinical space might be the most exciting in this area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. That'd be a really nice care package, right, to start, you know, like the BioSense plus a CGM plus an Oura ring, and then some nice interface to integrate the three things. And then, yeah, validated learning, right? You've got like a really deep understanding how your behaviors are getting the numbers that you see on the dashboard. That'd be awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's really the next step, as you mentioned, right? We're really in the data gathering phase right now. And then after we've, you know, sufficiently gathered enough data, then we can start to think about those types of predictions. We can start to think about analytics. We can start to think about alerts being generated for the patient or the provider that's like, you know, hey, this number typically correlates with this number and it's getting a little bit too high, you know, things like that that are really interesting that would also allow the clinicians to take on more patients without being overwhelmed, right? Because really what we want is we want to funnel more and more people into these preventative medicine programs because we know, right? We know that these dietary and lifestyle changes are so effective for people. And we want to enable clinicians to do that and actually be able to make data-driven decisions and to take on even more patients. So again, I think this, you know, both us and Dave are really excited about this space and, you know, we're really jazzed about that collaboration with Heads Up.
Yeah, I was also excited about your integration with Senza. I know Paul, who is the founder of Senza, and it's leagues above any other food logging app I've seen. And the reason is because they're using supervised machine learning to predict what I'm about to log. Like, it's like very predictable what I eat from day to day. And so rather than you having to pick stuff from some list or searching for foods and all this kind of stuff, like it just suggests what you're about to eat for lunch. And guess what? It's super accurate. And then also they have the best database of nutrients because again, they're using supervised machine learning to scan the nutrition facts panels, right? So you can take a picture of any nutrition facts panel and they will enter into their database. The chances are it's already there because they're so damn efficient at entering them. So yeah, I think that's a super cool app.
Right. No, absolutely. And I think, you know, really what our goal is, you know, along with Heads Up and some of these other biomarker tracking companies is not just to provide the data back, right? Because I think that, you know, the quantity of data these days is really not the issue for most people. In fact, people feel like they have too much data.
Right.
In a lot of cases. I think ultimately, yeah, exactly. Like you really want to be able to provide insights back to the patients. And, you know, in our case, again, kind of in this data gathering mode with breath acetone, you know, ultimately we really hope to be able to provide specific personalized insights and recommendations back to the users. And that's really the holy grail for us.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem like that much of a leap, does it, in Senza? If it knows your continuous glucose and the breath acetone, and it's predicting what I'm about to eat anyway, like maybe I could just choose the breath acetone that I want and it will tell me what to eat, right? Like maybe you tell it, like you take a picture of the inside of your fridge and then it tells you what to eat in order to hit a certain level of breath acetone. And of course, it's going to know your activity levels and then the sleep data from Aura and whatnot. And so I do think
the
holy grail, like predict telling me what to eat. I don't know, maybe somebody, some coach or somebody listening to this would be like, oh, you idiot, Chris, like you're just going to turn people into automata and they need to think for themselves.
I think I'll bring it up at the product meeting this week, Chris. Thanks.
Yeah, you get right on. Well, I think that was all I had. So tell me about the sort of the practical stuff. Is the meter available now or do you need to be part of some clinical trial or how does it work?
Nope. The Biosense device is available on our website. List price is $299. So our website is mybiosense.com. And there's information about our trial on that website. There's information about the device and why it's unique and why it's really the first device to track breath acetone as accurately as it does. So if folks are interested in learning about that technology, head over to mybiosense.com. And you can also purchase the device there as well.
Okay. And so are there going to be more clinical trials in the future? Do you have any questions that you'd like to answer with data?
Absolutely. Yeah. So as I mentioned, we've got a couple in the pipeline. Actually, we were supposed to have had two trials ongoing right now, but COVID kind of
put the kibosh
threw those off the rail. Yeah, exactly. So a lot of the academic centers really shut down a lot of the other clinical research that was not directly related to COVID. And so that happened to us with a couple of our trials. So they're really just kind of waiting for permission from the universities and the hospitals to restart that research. The latest indication that we got would be end of summer for turning those wheels back on. So anyway, we are interested in a lot of things, really. So the first and most obvious is a weight loss and obesity trials. So these are related to, you know, the concentration of your breath acetone with our device and that area under the curve in ketone dose and its correlation with fat loss. So that's, you know, I think something that is top of mind for us. But there are folks who are interested in working with us on oncology trials, people who are interested in neurological disorders. So, I mean, as you know, there's so many applications for low carbon, for ketogenic diets. And, you know, we have a lot of inbound interest from researchers interested in tracking and remote patient monitoring with our device.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I know ketones have got so many benefits. It almost sounds like snake oil, and it's like too good to be true.
Yeah, well, you really have to be careful about the snake oil thing. So that's why clinical research is so important, because I do think there are probably folks on the extreme end of the spectrum who think that it can cure everything. And obviously, you know, we need proof for any claim that's going to be made. So, you know, this idea of supporting trials and supporting remote patient monitoring, because, you know, let's face it, you know, in the case of a lot of these interventions, the trial coordinators or the clinicians don't have good ways to track their patients.
Right. So that's what I was about to say is, like, is this breath acetone thing about to become the new gold standard for doing clinical trials where previously you were using the Abbott Precision Extra?
Right. Yeah, we hope so. We hope so. And that's really the aim here. Also for, you know, just trying to enable good science. I mean, you know, the founding members of the company, the first three out of the first four members of the company have scientific backgrounds and are scientifically trained. So I think, you know, in addition to our commercial responsibilities, we're highly interested and the company mission is highly aligned to supporting research initiatives and really trying to further scientific discovery as well as the commercial angle, and as well as supporting clinicians who are trying to treat patients with these therapies. So absolutely, we have a huge interest in supporting research activities and learning alongside the researchers.
Well, I find that to be tremendously admirable. You know, I mean, we talked at the beginning about the challenges for the academic and the entrepreneurial environment. You think about most tech products, you don't need to do a clinical trial to show that Trello.com or Google Drive is useful, right? Like, you can just go ahead and sell it. Whereas in this space, you really do need to have some data and approval by various authorities and whatnot, which is just like a huge hurdle for you as a tech startup, surely.
Absolutely. And it helps to have, you know, good people in the ring with you. You know, Jim McCarter is a huge advocate for us, and that's hugely beneficial to have such a reputable researcher in our corner. So that's definitely opened up some doors for us in the research avenue, and that we're not just doing, you know, clinical research with anyone. We're really targeting top researchers in the field. And that's, you know, something I feel very fortunate to have the opportunity to work with.
That's excellent. Do you miss physics?
I do. Sometimes I do. I'll say unequivocally, I do. And I know it because sometimes, you know, one of my old friends, or I'll read an article that has some sort of, you know, esoteric physics in it, and I get giddy whenever I see it, I have to admit. So, you know, I get my dose of physics here and there, but absolutely.
The thing that gives me physics envy is how easy it is to generate data, right? You probably know this, that you, in your world, there's just oodles and oodles of data, and the main problem is finding somewhere to put it and then processing it all. Whereas you do this clinical trial for breath acetone, and people are literally bleeding in order for you to obtain one observation that you can use to train your model.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and actually, it's funny you mentioned that, because that's probably the biggest difference between physical science and health science, is the introduction to all the nuance and complexity surrounding clinical research and data quality and confounders and all of those things, right? Because when you do physical science, I think the hard part is pulling off the experiment. Or in my case, I was, you know, a device physicist. So it was building a device that actually worked well enough to give you the data that you needed. But once you had the data, you had the data. It was, you know, relatively straightforward to then interpret it. In the clinical research space, once you have the data, that feels like just the beginning, right? That feels like, you know, the beginning of your analysis period and all the different things you have to think about and control for. And it's just a whole new world. And it's one that I've really enjoyed learning about.
Oh, that's fantastic. And can you tell us about where we can find you online? Are you a Twitter or a LinkedIn or somewhere else online that where people can find you specifically?
Sure. So I haven't been on the social media lately. I've been taking a break. I'm on a social media diet.
I'm very sympathetic to that. will it show up in your breath acetone?
Yeah. Actually, maybe that's our next trial, is social media use and ketone levels.
Yeah.
But no, you can find me on LinkedIn. Trey Suntrup is my name on LinkedIn. So I think it's just the regular LinkedIn address / Trey Suntrup.
Excellent. Well, this has been fantastic, Trey. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you.
Thanks, Chris. Love talking to you.
That's great. Thank you.